Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
So for the folks on the internet, here's what happened. A month ago, we taught on 1 Corinthians 10 and 11, and then we took 2 weeks off. The first one off because I was in Chattanooga, and then we took the next Wednesday off because the following weekend was homecoming weekend, and then we intended to be back the following Wednesday, but no, I got to have the flu again. So it's been a month since we've been here, as hard as that is to believe, and I wondered if anybody would show up, so I'm very pleased that all of you showed up tonight. And tonight, we have every intention of getting those Israelites through the water. That's the plan tonight. If we get them all the way through the water and get to the song that they sing in celebration of their deliverance, if we get all the way through that, which is 2.5 chapters tonight, but they're reasonably short chapters and they're relatively narrative chapters. So even though we'll stop and talk a bit of theology along the way because I can't help myself, we should be able to do that. And if we do, then you get bonus apologetics tonight. Ooh, I know. Ooh, ah.
What's an apologetic?
So, bonus apologetics. I kick you and then I go, I'm so sorry. And then I apologize profusely. Actually, comes from the Greek word apologia that means to give a defense for something. So when you're doing theology that defends the Bible or defends Christianity, that's called giving an apologetic for it. And so even though we think of the word apology as, oh, I'm so sorry, actually its root is to defend. And so we can do some extra theological apologetics tonight if we get all the way through the Exodus section. So Exodus 13 is where we're beginning. The last time that we saw the Israelites, they had just gone through the Passover experience. The death angel had passed through all of Egypt, killing the firstborn of every household, the firstborn of the beasts. That's important to remember because tonight we're going to read that God says, now since I spared all your firstborn, I'm going to take all your firstborn to myself. The firstborn of every household and the firstborn of every animal now belongs to God. And you have to know that he's basing that on the fact that the death angel did not take their firstborn before they left Egypt. So starting at chapter 13, verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, sanctify to me every firstborn. What does it mean when he says sanctify there? We've talked a lot about this concept of sanctification, holiness, the word saint, hagios in the New Testament. What does it mean?
Set aside for me.
Set aside for me. Kodesh is the Hebrew word. It means to set aside for God's purpose and use. So here we see that word used again. Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast, it belongs to me. And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out from Egypt, from the house of slavery, for by a powerful hand the Lord brought you out from this place, and nothing leavened shall be eaten. On this day in the month of Abib, you are about to go forth. So they left on the night of Passover, the 14th. This is now the 15th of Abib, or later called Nisan. And so on the 15th day is the day of unleavened bread. I think we have covered that topic now to the point of exhaustion. Does everybody get the relationship now of Passover on the 14th, day of unleavened bread on the 15th, week-long eating of unleavened bread to remind them that they left Egypt in such a hurry that there wasn't time for their bread to rise, and so every year they would stop and observe and remember their deliverance. So verse 4 says, on this day in the month of Abib, you are about to go forth, and it shall be when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall observe this rite in this month. So he has said now, I'm going to take you to the land, the promised land, the land that I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When you get there, you will always remember this date. You'll always stop and remember your deliverance every year. For 7 days you'll eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten throughout the 7 days, and nothing leavened shall be seen among you. Nor shall any leaven be seen among you in all of your borders. And you shall tell your son on that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. In other words, you would stop and do this specifically so that your kids would say, why? Why do we do this? And that gives you the opportunity to explain over and over for all the generations of Israel how it is that God, by his mighty hand, delivered Israel out of Egypt. Because God is very, very big on remembering. And he'll even mark time by these feasts of remembrance. Verse 9 then says, it shall serve as a sign to you on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, that the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. For with a powerful hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. Now remember that Moses is writing from the perspective of already knowing the rest of the story. He already knows that the law is coming at Mount Sinai, which the Israelites didn't know at this moment. They're still headed toward the Red Sea. They haven't been to Sinai yet, but Moses knows all this. And so one of the things that, to this day, you'll see Orthodox Jews wearing a headband that has a scroll of the Torah on their forehead, and they have their leather wrap with the Torah on their hand. That's the type of thing that Moses is referring to here. And the same way that they would wrap their hand in their head to remember the law of God, he said that's the way you're to treat the Passover and the unleavened bread. It's to be like that, something you never forget, something you never stop doing. It's going to be like the Torah that is bound to your hand, that you would work the Torah, bound to your head, that you would remember the Torah. That's how important these feasts are. That's what he's telling Israel. So then verse 10. Therefore, you shall keep this ordinance as it is an appointed time from year to year. Now it shall come about that when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, as he swore to you and to your fathers and gives it to you, that you shall devote to the Lord the first offspring of every womb and the first offspring of every beast that you own. The males belong to the Lord. But every first offspring of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. Now that's just really interesting language. Because God just said, the firstborn male of every family belongs to me. Then he said, the firstborn animal belongs to me. But of all the animals, every time you have a firstborn donkey, how many folks here have a King James Version in front of you? Oh, okay. And so, of course, we all know that the word there is not donkey, is it? No, it's not. You know what the word is. It's the old English word for donkey, which is ass. And so he says, whenever you have a firstborn donkey, stubborn mule, ass, you must redeem it with a lamb. So he's teaching, again, substitutionary atonement, that the donkey, when it's born, needs to be redeemed, needs to have something die in its place. And then notice what he says about it. And if you do not redeem it, then you have to break its neck. Those are the two choices when a donkey is born. Either it gets redeemed by the lamb, or it dies. Broken neck. Those are the two options. You think God's trying to teach something already?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, is that just figuratively they need to be redeemed by the lamb, or does that mean that they actually take a baby lamb?
It actually means that they take a lamb and kill it in order for the donkey to live. Right? So they have a firstborn donkey. It belongs to the Lord. The Lord gets to say what to do with it. It's his. So what he says is the firstborn donkey has to be redeemed. You have to kill a lamb in its place, or you have to kill it. You have to break its neck so it dies. So either way, because it belongs to the Lord, it's going to be redeemed or it's going to be destroyed. Those are the two options for the firstborn donkey. Because God is teaching. So having laid out that rule about donkeys, in verse 14, he says, and it shall be that when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? Why do we do this? Then you'll say to him, With a powerful hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. And it came about that Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go. So the Lord killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord the males, the first offspring of every womb, but every firstborn of my sons I redeem. Now, as we progress, as God continues to create the law and the theology of redemption, he's going to specify ways that the firstborn can be redeemed, because for each family to give their firstborn to the Lord, the question becomes, to do what? Why are we giving all our sons? Where do they go? Who takes care of them? What is all that? So God's going to set aside one tribe out of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he's going to say, instead of giving me all your firstborn sons, I'm just going to take a tribe to myself. And he takes the tribe of Levi and says, now Levi is mine to replace all those firstborn sons. So when your firstborn child was born, of course you would redeem it. You'd redeem it with a lamb. You could keep your child in your household if it had been redeemed with a sacrificial lamb. But then God's going to take all of Levi. And once he takes the tribe of Levi to himself, he says, now when you come into the promised land, the other 11 tribes are going to get land and get an inheritance, and it's going to be their land permanently. And every 50 years, however I've allotted the land, it's going to go back to those allotments, every family, every tribe getting exactly what I promised them from the beginning. So God's going to permanently give every tribe land that they can grow and that they can expand and that they can live and have their animals and have their fields. But the tribe of Levi gets nothing, no land inheritance. Instead, they are devoted to the work of the Lord. They are the ones that are separated, set aside for God. So they don't get an inheritance within the land. But each of the other 10 tribes has to give 10% of everything to the Levites. So even though God is their inheritance, if you just think about it mathematically, if you're like, let's say you're the tribe of Reuben, you get your land allotment, and then you plant and you sow and you reap and your animals grow, but you have to give the first fruit and the tithes all to Levi. So you get to keep 90% of whatever your land creates, and 10% goes to Levi. Levi gets nothing, but he gets 10% of the other 11 tribes, which means that Levi actually comes away with 110%. So even though he doesn't get an inheritance and he has to work for God and is completely dependent on God for his living, livelihood, and food, he actually ends up with more than any of the other tribes because God is just and fair. So it came about that Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, said verse 15. Verse 16 said, it shall serve as a sign on your hand and as phylacteries on your forehead, for with a powerful hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. In other words, remember it. Seal it to your hand, seal it to your forehead. Remember that God did this. Now it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though that was the shorter route. For God said, lest the people change their mind when they see war and they return to Egypt. So God's being very clever here, very cunning. The short route to the promised land would have been through the land of the Philistines. But he has just delivered these slaves. They've been slaves for 400 years. They don't know anything about war. They don't know anything about fighting. And so he says, if I take them to the Philistines, war's going to break out, and the people are going to become disheartened, and they're so close to Egypt, they'll just turn around and go back in. So I'm going to take them the long way around, but he knows full well that by taking them the long way around, he's going to push them right up against the edge of the Red Sea. Because he knows what he's doing. He's going to right away show them his mighty hand in deliverance. So then verse 18, so God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. Now, do you think God knew when he said, okay, the short way is going to be this way, but that way is going to cause war. I'm going to take them the long way around. Do you think he knew that they were just going to bump headlong into this massive body of water that was going to stop their forward progress? Not only does he know that, but in a minute we're going to read that God hardens Pharaoh's heart again to cause Pharaoh to go chase the Israelites. So God is setting these people up. He pushes them right up against the edge of the Red Sea and then makes sure that they're being chased by their enemy army. God did all that on purpose. This is the sort of sovereign God we're talking about, the one who does exactly what he wants to do to get himself glory. Verse 19 tells us, "And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, 'God will surely take care of you, and you will carry my bones from here with you.'" That's just this wonderful little interjection that Moses throws in here, that they took the bones of Joseph with them. How is it that the Israelites were in Egypt to begin with?
Because of Joseph.
Because Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers. He ends up there in Pharaoh's household. Pharaoh has the dream. He's been in prison. He interprets the dream. He becomes second only to Pharaoh. And then he brings all his brothers in, gives his brothers the land of Goshen and the best land, sets them up as the Hyksos, the shepherd kings. And then Exodus started with, there rose up a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. So Joseph is the pivotal element to how it is that they were in Egypt in the first place. And yet, even though Joseph was second only to Pharaoh, had all this wealth, all this power, had sons with an Egyptian woman, nevertheless, he made all of his brethren promise to take his bones with them and bury them in the land of promise that God had promised them. That's how sure Joseph was that the Israelites were leaving. 400 years before they left, he was already sure that they were leaving. And so he said, "When you go, take my bones. Don't leave me in Egypt, because this is not home." That's how confident he was that God's word was going to be true. And he was hanging on to the promise that God made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Verse 20 then says, "Then they set out from Succoth, and they camped in Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night." That should be familiar. When God made the promise to Abraham that we call the Abrahamic covenant, God put Abraham to sleep after Abraham had divided several animals. And then do you remember what passed through the animals? God in what form?
Fire.
Fire and?
Smoke.
Pillar of cloud, pillar of fire. So when God formed the covenant, he formed it with the same symbols that are leading the children of Israel here out of Egypt back to the land he promised in the Abrahamic covenant. This should be enough for any Israelite to say, well, that would be the same symbol of the same God who promised us we were going. He appeared to Abraham in exactly this form. He made us this promise that we were coming back to this land. And now here we go back to that land. This should have given them every reason to say, good enough. Now, by the way, we have to talk for a moment then about human individual responsibility and will. Because there is that theology out there that says all people need in order to believe or make a decision for God is adequate proof, an adequate inducement, a good reason, and people should be able to believe God if they just have enough good reason to believe God. Wouldn't the pillar of fire and the pillar of smoke be good enough? And yet that pillar of fire and smoke is going to lead them to the edge of the Red Sea, and they're all going to go, "Oh, great, Moses, you brought us out here to die." No faith whatsoever, no confidence in God, pillar of fire, pillar of smoke, still no ability to believe. Is that remarkable? You would think that if you individually had 5 good minutes of being led by a pillar of fire and pillar of smoke, that you would hang on to that moment the rest of your life. You would tell people. People would say, "Well, why do you believe?" And you say, "Well, I had 5 minutes with a pillar of fire and a pillar of smoke. Should have seen it. It was unbelievable. Yeah, it led us around for about 5 good minutes. You'd hang on to that the rest of your life."
That's what you'd think.
You would think you'd hold on to that the rest of your life. These people still are being led by the fire and the smoke, and listen to their complete lack of trust. The point being, human beings left to themselves, no matter how adequate the proof, no matter how big the evidence, unless they have the Holy Spirit of God indwelling them, producing faith in them, left to themselves in their own flesh, they're just not gonna believe. And they've seen more evidence and proof of God than I've seen in my life. And they don't believe. I only have this word, and I believe and am hanging my life on it. The contrast is enormous. And the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light so that they could travel by day and by night. And he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. It's right there. It's right in front of us. Where's God? Well, he's right there. He's right, pillar of fire, pillar of smoke. We haven't ever seen that before. There it is. And it's leading the way. It's moving. And it's leading the way. And you would think that would be enough for them to go. Not only 40 years of, you know, the cloud moving them wherever it wants them to go. Not only do they have the tabernacle and learn how to please God and worship and atone to God. And every day they get up and there's food from heaven. Manna coming down from heaven every day. 40 years. And God is going to strew their bones in the wilderness and not let anybody go in from this first generation that leaves Egypt. None of them are going to go into the promised land for their complete lack of faith, with the exception of two old guys who go, yeah, that's good enough for me, I'll go. Joshua and Caleb, exactly. So chapter 14 says, now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell the sons of Israel, turn back and camp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, and you shall camp in front of Baal-zephon, opposite it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. So he's obviously got spies watching the movement of these million people. And when he finds out that they didn't take the direct route, but have gone over to the edge of the sea, Pharaoh's going to go, they don't know what they're doing. They're lost. Perfect opportunity. Let's go get them. Let's go wipe them out. Now, why are they lost at the edge of the sea? God put them there. Tell the sons of Israel, turn back. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they're wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. So who took responsibility for the fact that Pharaoh's army came after them?
God
did. Isn't that interesting? Yep. That God would put them up against the edge of the Red Sea and then bring their enemies up behind them. Why is he doing this?
Show them who's in control.
Show them his deliverance. He's going to say here that he's doing it to get glory for himself. God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself. I keep saying it over and over again. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they're wandering aimlessly, verse 4, so I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And they did so. They did exactly what God said they were going to do. Are we talking about saved people here?
No.
No, we're talking about enemies. Talking about the Egyptians. And God brings the Egyptians to the Red Sea for what purpose?
To drown them.
So that he'll get what?
Glory.
So he'll get glory for it. He's going to get glory and honor to himself by bringing the Egyptian army, whose firstborn he's just gotten done killing. And now he's going to bring the whole army out to the Red Sea to drown them for his glory. So what is God's primary interest in his dealings with human beings?
His glory.
It's all about his glory. God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself. When the king of Egypt, verse 5, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people. And they said, what is this we have done that we have let Israel go away from being our servants? So they made their chariots ready. They made Pharaoh's chariot ready. And he took his people with him, and he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. There it is again. We've seen that twice in the first 8 verses of chapter 14. When we think of God hardening Pharaoh's heart, we usually think about it in terms of the plagues leading up to the death of all the firstborn. But he continues to do it. God continues to harden Pharaoh's heart so that even after the firstborn dying, Pharaoh continues to do utterly, inexplicably stupid things. Wouldn't you think after all the plagues, the darkness, the frogs, the lice, all that, and then the death of all your firstborn, wouldn't any logical person conclude that God is fighting for the Israelites? God is on the side of the Israelites, and he keeps kicking us around. Smart people would say, we should let them go. Because every time we do anything to them, we get hurt worse. We should let them go. So how do you explain Pharaoh going after them again? It can only be because God hardened his heart. I think he did more than just harden his heart. I think he hardened his brain because he's not thinking well here. So let's go get them. Let's go chase them. Verse 8, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all their horses and their chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal-Zephon. And as Pharaoh drew close, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. And so the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us out here into the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us this way, bringing us out of Egypt?" In other words, we could have died in Egypt. Why would you bring us out here to die? Aren't there any graves in Egypt where we could be buried? All you've done is bring us out here into the wilderness so that we could all die. And it looks like certain death at this moment. You got the Red Sea in front of you. You got the enemy army behind you. And look at the way Moses described the size of the army. All of the horsemen, all of the chariots, all of the soldiers coming down on this mass of people. It looks like certain death. Except for the fact that there's this pillar of fire and this pillar of smoke. And oh yeah, the death angel didn't kill any of our children. And oh yeah, when it was dark in Egypt, we had light. And when they had all those plagues, we didn't. Logic would say, God's on our side. God's going to fight for us. He didn't bring us out here just to kill us. And yet, typical of human flesh, they saw it through those very human eyes and said, oh great, you brought us out here to kill us. Great, thanks Moses. Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt? They go on to argue in verse 12, saying, leave us alone that we can serve the Egyptians. Is this remarkable? Now they're arguing in favor of their slavery. Why would you bring us out here? We told you to leave us alone. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. That's how sure they are they're going to die. Mm-hmm. After everything they've been through, still no confidence. But Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. Why? They'll be underwater. Exactly. You're never going to have to worry about these anymore. But look at how he says it. He doesn't say, get ready to fight. He doesn't say, defend yourself. He says, stand still. In other words, do nothing. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Stand here and watch. God is going to fight for you. God is going to defend you. God is going to save you. And your part is quit trying and quit worrying and quit complaining. Just stand still and pay attention to the fact that God knows what he's doing. That's a lesson I think we could all learn occasionally because we get very worked up about where is God in all this? I think we need to be reminded every once in a while, Just stand still and trust. He's there. He knows what he's doing. Sure, he may have brought you right up to the edge of the Red Sea, and it looks like the army that's going to kill you is bearing down on you. So stand still, because you can't beat the army, and you can't swim the sea. So what are your options?
Nothing.
Trust. Just stand there and trust. Because either God's going to deliver you, or you're going to get killed. Those are really your two options. You're either drowning, dying, or trusting. Yes, sir.
Another piece of evidence points toward the Pharaoh's heart was hardened. If I were him and my heart wasn't hardened and I went after them and I saw the Red Sea part, I probably would have just given up.
Absolutely. Well, it's going to say that again. I mean, it's God that's going to drive them into the sea. Because, yeah, once you see the Red Sea part, you ought to pretty much be going, I can't do that. And I don't have any gods that can do that. But their God is doing it. You would think, right? A smart guy would go, home, lads. We're going home. Come on. That's good enough for me. Back to Egypt. We're good.
Unless they won't keep it open for us, I guess.
Yeah, isn't that remarkable? Hey, you know that God that killed all our firstborn?
Yeah.
That, you know, made the Nile blood and gave us the darkness and all that? I'll bet he'll hold this open for us.
But God loves everybody.
Because he loves everybody, exactly. So what you're saying is that Pharaoh was Arminian? Is that what you're arguing for? So Moses said to the people, do not fear, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you have seen today, you'll never see again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Keep silent means stop the complaining, which is all they've been doing. Whining and complaining. You brought us out here to kill us. So Moses says two things. Number one, God's going to fight for you. You have plenty of evidence of it. You've seen his faithfulness to you. He's going to fight for you. And number two, shut up.
What translation is that?
That's the Jim translation. But isn't that the essence of be quiet?
Yes.
How frequently do we find ourselves in those situations where it looks like there's no way out, there's no deliverance, and what do? First instinct, right, start running your mouth. Start complaining. Just start yapping about how bad you've got it. Despite the fact that you have a whole history of God taking care of you. You have a whole history of God providing for you. You have a whole history of being ridiculously spoiled. And yet the first time something goes bad, we're very quick to start flapping our jaws and talking about where's God and how did this happen and I thought you loved me and why are you doing this to me? And I think this is wonderful advice. Be quiet and see the deliverance of God. Because once you know that you're in that place where either God's going to deliver you or you're going to die, the best thing to do is be quiet and just see what he does. Be quiet, trust, and wait for him to deliver. Anybody in this room ever been through a circumstance that you thought you would not survive? Yeah, pretty much everybody. Yeah. Did you survive it? Yeah. Yeah, we're here, right? We're here talking about it. Well, after a while of going through enough bad circumstances where you feel like you're just not going to make it, and then God takes you through it, you would think after a while, we would start to build up a confidence that the same God who got me through the last one and the one before that and all the others, that God's going to get me through this one too because I have a long history of him doing it. So a smart person would shut up and let him do it again and just wait for him to do it. Because the only two options you have is he's going to do it or you're going to die. Those are your options. So wait for him to deliver you. So then, the sea, let's start at verse 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Isn't that a great question? Why are you crying out to me? Do you think God didn't know the circumstances? I mean, Israel could make the argument, have you not seen the army? Did you not notice the sea in front of us? Did you not realize we're about to die here? God's answer, what's your problem? Why are you crying out to me? What are you complaining about? I mean, I'm here, aren't I? I'm God, aren't I? I'm the one that delivered you. What are you complaining about?
Smoke and fire.
Smoke and fire. Hello. Yeah. Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. To which they would respond, Red Sea, lots of water, drowning. So, and as for you, Moses, lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. And as for me, God talking about what he's going to do now, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, this is what you mentioned, Ben, so that they will go into the sea after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. So God said, I'm going to make them go into the sea after you. I'm going to kill them all, and I'm going to get the glory. I'm going to get the honor. Now, really try to get a hold of that for a moment, because that is so different than the way we think about God, especially if you think about a God who loves everybody equally and wants to give everybody the same chance and all that. He is saying that he is going to be honored in delivering the people that belong to him, and he is going to deliver them because they do belong to him. They are his. And because they're his, he's going to deliver them. The second half of how he's going to get honor to himself is that he's going to drown the enemies of his people. And both of those things glorify God. And for the humanists out there, they would say, well, that's just not fair. God can't be that partial. He can't treat one group of people that well and the other group that badly. The other group, the Egyptians, must have chosen not to believe in God. They must have had an opportunity and then said, no, they didn't want to. But Moses doesn't allow for that. Three times now he said, God hardened his heart. God hardened his heart. God did that. Here's God saying, I'm going to harden his heart in advance so that he will follow you into the sea. God completely confident in what he's going to do in dividing his people from his enemies. And in both cases, God is glorifying himself because God is sovereign. Absolutely, completely, utterly sovereign, which means he can do whatever he wants with whatever is his, and everything that's his is everything. Was that a good sentence?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Everything that is his. And since everything that is his, he can flood the whole earth if he wants. Mm-hmm. He can destroy the whole thing with fire. He can save his own. He can write down particular names, choose and elect them, forgive them, redeem them, and bring them to himself. Because everything is his, and out of everything that is his, he can exercise whatever option he wants. And as long as it redounds to his glory, he's willing to do it. Which means, again, man, when you hit your knees tonight, say thank you. Because you weren't an Egyptian. You weren't born an enemy. You weren't born somebody that God will be glorified in condemning. People have a hard time dealing with the whole concept of judgment, damnation, hell. That's hard for people. Until you see it through the lens of God glorifying himself. And then it starts to make sense because hell will stand as a testimony to God's holiness. For all eternity, God will be able to declare, I am so holy and so righteous that I punish sin severely and eternally. And hell is a testament to God's righteousness. And he'd be just as glorified and just as holy if he put everybody in there. And yet some people he delivered through the Red Sea because they were his. And how did they become his? He chose them. You're mine. Israel, mine elect, he calls them. Jacob, my chosen. You're mine, and because you're mine, I'm going to deliver you. So now we say that we as Christians, believers in Christ, we are God's chosen. We are his elect. We belong to him. Therefore, we know that he's going to deliver us into our promise. He's going to deliver us to the heaven that he has always promised us. And he's not going to take everybody. And he is going to judge some people. And in both sides of that equation, he gets glory. Because he's in the enterprise of glorifying himself. And as different as that is from the man-made philosophies of what God is supposed to be like, it is nevertheless the only God you find in the Bible. And so when you read these kind of passages, I mean, how early in the Bible are we here? And we see God exercising absolute sovereignty over dividing of people. And by the way, let me also point out, were the Israelites at this point being delivered because they were so good and faithful?
No,
they're whining the whole way. Do you think among the Egyptians, the whole Egyptian army, do you think there were any people in the Egyptian army that were just good people? Just doing their job? Yeah, just getting up every day, going to work, providing for their family, love their wife, take care of their kids. Huh?
They just weren't chosen.
They just weren't chosen. They just weren't gods. The theology that we promote so often here of God's sovereign election is all the way through this Bible. I get tired of being asked, where do you get that in the Bible? And I go, that would be the answer, in the Bible. That would be your answer right there. It's everywhere. It's all through here. So verse 19 says, and the angel of God who had been going before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, and it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel. And there was the cloud along with darkness, yet it gave light at night, and thus one did not come near the other all night long. In other words, the image here is that the cloud and the fire, the pillars that had been leading Israel, now removed from being in front of them and went up behind them, dividing the army of Egypt from all the Israelites. And on one side, it stayed fire, so all through the night, it lit up the Red Sea so that they had light to go across. And on the other side, darkness, so that Pharaoh's army had to slow down and come to a stop. And then, of course, you're going to see as they work their way through the sea that it's also going to confuse them to cause them to drown. So, verse 21, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night. See, it was all night that they were going through here, which is why they needed the fire to light their way. So the waters were divided. And the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on dry land. Which, by the way, would a seabed be dry naturally?
Nope.
No, that'd be really muddy and hard to travel across. So this east wind apparently didn't just separate the water. It was so strong it worked like a giant blow dryer. And it dried out the land so that they were able, a million people, to traverse across a seabed. So there are several miraculous things going on here. It turned the sea into dry land so that the waters were divided. Verse 22, and the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. I just love that picture. I love that image because I wonder if it was like going through the Chattanooga Aquarium. Wouldn't you think that they could get like halfway through and look to their right and their left and see fish? Stuff in the water? I think it would just be marvelous. So. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. Why did they do that?
Because their hearts were hardened.
It's exactly right. And it came about at the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and the cloud, and he brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. So he waited till they were right in the middle, and then he starts confusing and causing problems for them. Verse 25, he caused their chariot wheels to swerve and come off, and he made them drive with difficulty so that the Egyptians said, finally, finally, they come to their senses and say, let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians. Gee, what was your first clue? Yeah, see, exactly. Charlie goes, you think? Exactly. How many clues do you need that God is on the side of Israel? Only if God hardened their hearts would they continue this pursuit. And so not only did he harden their hearts and cause them to pursue, when he got them into the middle, he caused confusion and knocks off down their chariots and takes off their wheels so that they can't drive. And then they figure out, you know, we shouldn't be here. We're right in the middle of the Red Sea. We should go home now. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and over their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Which means that when they turned around and were trying to head out of it, that's the direction from which God brought the water. So that they were fleeing right back into the flood that overwhelmed them. So let's look at verse 28. The end of 27 said, then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them, and not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right side and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore, which means bodies of Egyptians would have been coming up with the waves and landing on the seashore. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Now, before you get too excited about this most recent bout of belief they're having, soon they're going to start complaining about water, and then they're going to complain about food, and then God's going to give them water out of a rock, and then food out of heaven, and then after a while, you know, that free food every day that comes down from heaven, they reach the point where they say, my soul hates this light bread. I wish I had some meat to eat. Oh, remember the leeks and onions and the garlics we used to eat in Egypt? Oh, those were good. So they're not happy with the food God provides for them every day. So don't get too excited about the fact that at this point they feared the Lord and believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. But they do break out into song. They do break out into celebration. Yes?
Do we have any idea how far it was that they walked? How many miles?
No. You know, every so often you can turn on those A&E programs or those History Channel programs that try to explain this in some kind of natural circumstances. The most recent one I saw said that the translation is wrong, that it wasn't the Red Sea, it was the Sea of Reeds. And in typical anachronistic form, they say, well, the Sea of Reeds now, every year, when it's at low stage, there are sandbars that go across it. And so it could very well be that the Israelites passed over this very small sea on sandbars at low tide, and that explains everything. But none of the natural explanations explain. Either you have to say, okay, well, then there was still a miracle because God drowned the entire Egyptian army on sandbars in 2 inches of water. That's pretty remarkable. There's no natural way to explain this. It's written so miraculously. But the distance from shore to shore, I haven't found anywhere. No, I don't know. Do you know? Have you seen any estimates? Anybody seen estimates? I would say, though, logic would say that it had to be a big enough distance that you could get all of the Egyptian army in it. Hmm. Yeah. So that's got to be a pretty major distance.
I'm trying to picture a million people walking even 10 miles through the middle of this.
Yeah. Well, we see that it took all night. I mean, they started at the beginning of the night, and then it says at daybreak is when he drowned the Egyptians. So it took all night just to get everybody through and then bring the Egyptian army behind them. Then also the language says, you know, that as they were in the middle of it, the Egyptian army realized we got to go back as their wheels were coming off and as they were in confusion. And then the flood was coming from the opposite direction when they turned around, which may have meant that the end of the Israelites were still on their way up the other side. So who knows? It was an enormous military expedition to get that many people through the Red Sea, certainly. So then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its chariot he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will extol him. The Lord is a warrior, and the Lord, Jehovah, is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deeps cover them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, is majestic in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. And the greatness of your excellence, you do overthrow those who rise up against you. Thou dost send forth thy burning anger, and it consumes them like chaff. And at the blast of your nostrils, the water was piled up. The flowing waters stood up like a heap, and the deeps were congealed into the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified against them. I will draw out my sword, and my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow with thy wind, and the sea covered them, and they sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like thee among the gods, O Lord? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? Thou didst stretch out thy right hand, and the earth swallowed them. In thy loving kindness, thou hast led thy people, whom thou hast redeemed. So I got to stop there for a moment. The first half of that song is all about you destroyed your enemies. And in destroying your enemies, you showed that you are powerful and you are mighty and you are majestic and that you deserve praises. Then by contrast, in verse 13, in loving kindness, you led the people who you have redeemed. Now remember that Moses has the advantage of hindsight at this point. And the word that he used there that's translated redeemed is a particular kind of redemption that's going to be written about later in the law, which is called the redemption of the kinsman redeemer. In other words, remember I told you earlier that when Israel went into the land that they were promised, they were all going to be given parcels, portions of land, according to what God gave them, what God determined for them, according to their size and their number and different allotments of land. And you would own that land forever. And so every 50 years, there was what was called the Year of Jubilee, when all the land would return to its original owners because God was determined that the land was going to stay divided the way he divided it. However, over the course of that 50-year period, you yourself might run out of money or fall on hard times or even sell yourself into slavery or debt. You may have all kinds of problems where you would lose your right to your land. Well, one of the ways that you could be restored would be if your nearest kinsperson, the person most closely related to you, was willing to pay the redemption price for what you lost. And that was called the kinsman redeemer. Any of you familiar with the book of Ruth? If you read the book of Ruth, you'll read about the fact that she comes across a man who, it turns out, is her kinsman redeemer. And then he ends up saying, well, there is one that's closer than me. So they have to go and check with him and say to him, will you redeem the land that belongs to Ruth? And if not, then I'm going to do it. And so he decides, no, he doesn't want to, when he finds out that Ruth comes as part of the package deal. Then the next kinsman can do it. And so this is the concept of the kinsman redeemer. Now, the reason that's so important is that when Christ came, the New Testament tells us frequently that he took on flesh and blood and became our elder brother. All that language of family and brotherhood, and we're part of his body, he then becomes our close kin. And so he could redeem that belonged to God that had been lost in the fall. He becomes our kinsman redeemer. And to be a kinsman redeemer, you have to, number one, have the price adequate to buy back what had been lost. You have to be willing to do it, and then you have to actually pay the price. And then you are the kinsman redeemer. That's the word, my point being, that's the word that Moses used here when he said that God has, in his loving kindness, led the people whom he redeemed. He paid the price to bring them out of Egypt. He redeemed them. Now, hold on to that for a moment, because he's going to use a second word in just a moment. In thy strength, you have guided them to your holy habitation. And the peoples have heard, and they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Phoenicia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed, and the leaders of Moab, trembling, grips them, and all the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Well, this, of course, is all prophetic. This is all what's going to happen as they head toward Canaan, and the story of their deliverance from Egypt precedes them. All of those people are going to be in fear. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed, and the leaders of Moab trembled against them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. And by the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone until your people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom you have purchased. Different word now. First, he said, these are the people you have redeemed, kinsman redeemer. The second word actually does have to do with buying, purchasing for the purpose of setting these free. It's the idea of buying slaves off the slave market to free them. This concept is then carried over into the New Testament. And whenever we talk about redemption, we also talk about Christ having the price of ransom. When you're talking about ransom price and Christ becoming a ransom for us, as Paul says, that's what he's talking about, paying the actual price and Christ being the price to purchase his people. Now, having said all that, we have two firm concepts about God redeeming and purchasing his people, prefiguring, pre-shadowing what Christ is going to do in redeeming and purchasing his people. Hold on to that for a second. We're going to finish the song, and that's going to make it a quarter after eight. And I told you we would have a little bonus apologetics moment. So if you want to invest another 10 minutes when we get done with the song here, I'll throw in the free bonus stuff. Hold on to the idea until the people pass over whom thou hast purchased. Verse 17 says, you will bring them and plant them on the mountain of their inheritance, of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thy dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. For the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took up a timbrel, which is basically a tambourine, in her hand, and all the women went out with her with their timbrels, and they were dancing. And Miriam answered them and said, sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has hurled into the sea. So there's a great deal of celebrating and a great deal of excitement over the fact that God had gotten himself glory. But in the midst of this song, it has this typological information about the fact that Christ is going to redeem his people and purchase them. But in this instance, it is the Lord God Almighty who has purchased and redeemed Israel, his people. You got that? Now then, here's your bonus apologetic stuff. One of the most common questions you'll be asked as a Reformed thinker, as a Calvinistic thinker, people will constantly try to find passages in the Bible that appear to say that people either have a free will or that they can fall away or that they can choose against the will of God. And one of the most popular places they go is 2 Peter chapter 2. So turn into the New Testament and go to 2 Peter real quick. Because at this very moment, based on what we've just learned, we now can answer 2 Peter chapter 2. And since we will not be in this particular position again anytime soon, I thought I'd throw the bonus apologetics out here. 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2, starting at verse 1. But false prophets also rose among the people, just as there will also be false teachers among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves, and will follow their own sensuality, and because of them, the way of truth will be maligned. And the Arminian is quick to pounce on that and say, but 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1 says that there are people who have been bought by the Lord who then deny him. Doesn't that mean free will, Jim? Because after all, it says that they were purchased by the Lord, and since they were bought by the Lord, and then they denied the Lord, doesn't that mean that people can be bought by Christ in his redemptive work, and then later deny him? How can you say eternal security? How can you say there's no free will? Peter clearly says that there are people who are going to deny the Lord that bought them. Isn't that what it says? Okay, now based on everything we just learned, it's real easy to unravel that, and you're going to get it real quickly. In order to unravel this, we have to start with, who is Peter writing to? Who is Peter's ministry to? Is he writing to the church of Gentiles?
He's writing to the Jews.
He's writing to the Jews. That's exactly who his ministry is to. First Peter, his first epistle, he starts right out by identifying who he's writing to. And he says he's writing to the diaspora, the scattered Jews. And then he says where they've been scattered to. In fact, go back to 1 Peter chapter 1 real quickly. Chapter 1, verse 1 of 1 Peter. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens, as strangers. That's diaspora is the word. Who were scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who are chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father by the sanctifying work of the Spirit, that you may obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with his blood. So he's writing to elect Jews. It's very specific. Anytime you're talking about diaspora, you're talking about scattered Jews. If those cities he mentioned seem familiar, go back into the book of Acts and read about Pentecost and read about the scattered Jews who had come to Jerusalem at Pentecost when Peter spoke, and you'll find out it's from the same areas because those are the areas where the Jews who had left Jerusalem had scattered out into the Gentile areas. So he's writing to scattered Jews. That's the first thing you have to know. So he's writing about Jewish history, Jewish background. In his second epistle, he's clear to say he references backwards to his first epistle. So he's writing to the same group of people, believing Jews who have been scattered through this Middle Eastern area. Then he starts citing to them the Israelite history, and he talks to them about the deliverance of Moses. Now, the next thing you need to know is that is in chapter 2, verse 1, the word Lord there is not kurios. Remember Sunday we talked about the word kurios? And that kurios is the most commonly translated word for Lord. In this case, it is the word despotes in the Greek, which is where we get the English word despot. When we think of despot, what do you think of?
Tyrant.
That's exactly what we're talking about, a heavy-handed ruler. In fact, in this day and age, the word despot's a bad word. You know, when we talk about somebody who is ruling an area with an iron hand, where he's a despot, he's a bad guy. That's the word translated Lord there. So most of the modern translations, instead of translating it Lord, call it Almighty Lord. My translation says Master, to try to differentiate it from the concept of Lord as Jesus. People who read it and say denying the Lord that bought them always think that Lord means Christ, means Jesus. But it doesn't here. That's not the word. It's the Master, the Almighty, the Sovereign that bought them. So now the question is, do we have anywhere in Israelite history a reference to the Almighty God purchasing Israel?
Yes, in Exodus.
Yes, we just read it. And so can Peter, writing to Israelites, make a reference to people within Israel who would deny the God who bought them? Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what we're reading about in Exodus. We're reading about the fact that false heresies and false teachers would come into Israel and draw many people away, denying the Lord that bought them. And that's exactly what we just read about. Now, we know for a fact that in the song that's being sung in Exodus 15, it's very clear that God, who is being referenced here as the despotes, the master, the sovereign, that he bought Israel. But did that cause those Israelites to come to faith either in him or in Christ? No, because he's going to scatter their bones through the wilderness for their lack of faith. They are going to deny the Lord that bought them. Knowing that, Peter writes, but false prophets also arose among the people. Which people?
Israel.
Of course they did. We read about that all the time, the false prophets in Israel. And so there will also be false teachers among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the Master God who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves. Knowing that, does this verse teach that someone can lose their salvation? No, it doesn't. It's stating a historic fact. That in the history of Israel forever, there have always been those who would introduce damnable heresies and in so doing deny the Lord who purchased Israel nationally in his redeeming them out of Egypt. We just have to go back and look at the language and see what the language says. So you got that little bit of apologetic help for free tonight. Yes? Do you understand the argument? It all revolves around what does the word Lord mean and is it a reference to Jesus? It's not. It's despotes. It's not kurios.
In your translation, what word did it use instead of
Lord? It used master.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What does yours say?
It says Lord, and it has capital L. Lord,
what do your other translations have?
Mine has Lord.
Mine has master with a capital M.
Master with a capital M.
But it is. It's the God, the Father.
Right. What do you got, Tom?
The master.
The master. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, some of the later translations make an effort to distinguish it from Christ and therefore don't use the word Lord. But that's where the confusion comes from. People who always think of Lord as necessarily meaning Jesus, that's why they argue the way they do and say, well, this verse says that people deny the Jesus who purchased them. And the only purchasing we know of with Jesus is the work that he did at the cross. Well, then you would have a terrible problem if there was a passage in the Bible that said people can deny the Christ who actually redeemed people on the cross. And those redeemed people later deny him and bring in damnable heresies, now we really have a big problem. But you have to look behind the language, look at who he's writing to. He's writing to believing Jews who have been redeemed by Christ, but then he's making a reference to their Jewish history and referring back to the stuff we just read in Exodus in saying that God purchased Israel, God redeemed Israel in bringing them out of Egypt, and yet within Israel there were unbelievers who brought in damnable heresies against the master who bought them. And we have plenty of Old Testament scripture to support that reading. Do you understand it?
Yep.
See, next time somebody asks you about that, you go, ah, I got it. Oh, I can answer that. No problem.
Question.
Yes?
Okay. Are you saying that in Peter's time, there were heretics harassing the believing Jews?
Yes.
And he is making reference to the fact that there have always been Israelites that taught false teachings and denied God.
That is exactly and precisely it. You've got it completely. He is saying you have people bringing in damnable heresies against Christianity today, but it's always been that way. As long as there's been Israel, there have been false prophets, which we see in the Old Testament plenty of. And then he says, and when they do that, they deny the Lord that bought them. When did he buy them? When he brought them out of Egypt. Okay. Yep.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.